when we ended the last session, we were talking about privatization. So I wondered if you'd address that again for me, Jim. The feelings about whether privatization would work and the attempts in the past to try to privatize.
There are those, especially in Congress, who feel that privatization is the answer to mail service. They don't understand what that would mean, and briefly I would tell you what it would mean, because we've had an example of it already. And we just get over one hurdle and in comes another one, and including the attempt to privatize the mail service in 1972, when a man named Tom Murray started up the Independent Postal System of America, IPSA. He went as far as to dare to print stamps, postage stamps, he called them, from 5 cents to a dollar. He convinced a few people to send Christmas cards at a cheaper rate than the Postal Service. But we stopped him in his tracks when the lawyer for the branch, for the NALC, and the speaker went to Oklahoma, the base of privatization, and entered the federal courts proclaiming that there should only be one postal service, and that should be the U.S. Postal Service. He didn't have a leg to stand on. The judge let him know that. The judge ruled in our favor that the Postal Service is the only one that shall deliver the mail. That was quite a victory that we didn't fully appreciate at the time, but the more that we hear about privatization, the more concerned that we get about it. I attended a meeting in Phoenix, Arizona, at the university there, where a couple of Republican congressmen wanted to take us on for citing the need of a private postal service. At the end of the meeting, the audience was in unanimous agreement, other than the congresspeople, that only the letter carrier in the postal service should be responsible for the mail that enters their mailbox, and that their mailbox should be kept private. Fortunately, we have a law that no one may enter the mailbox except the letter carrier. An example of what privatization would mean would be what's happening where my son lives in New Zealand, where anybody can go in the mailbox, and anybody does. If you've got something that's monetarily valuable, you're risking having somebody come in there with a drugstore ad or a hardware ad and take out the investment or whatever you got in the mailbox. They don't like it over there, but they're stuck with it. So I think we're pretty safe, and I think Congress understands that, at least the majority of Congress understands that only the letter carrier, the respected letter carrier, who is trusted with the U.S. mails, millions of dollars a day are going through the mails, should be the people that enter their mailbox. And I hope we'll always keep it that way, regardless of the arguments that can be made against it. There's nothing like a letter carrier in uniform approaching that mailbox that people can depend upon for service. They're very fortunate that they have people that are trustworthy like that. And in fact, as I've stated many times in the past, it doesn't matter what it costs for that service. It matters what it's worth to have a dedicated, loyal, faithful, trustworthy carrier at your doorstep every day. And they are at your doorstep. They do many things. Each day of the year, some letter carrier somewhere saves a life or protects property along the way. He's part of the family in many routes, and they love him. And I'll never forget when, back in Detroit, when a letter carrier served his route for 25 years, happened to die. The people on that route asked the undertaker to drive the hearse up and down that route while they lined the curves, crying, bidding farewell to this letter carrier, because they loved him. He's part of the family. They know people from womb to tomb, and they deserve the credit that they're getting. Unfortunately, at the present time, There is anxiety about the mail service, but anybody with 6 years or more need not be concerned, because we do have the no layoff clause that people laughed at in the beginning but are now happy that it exists. We also have the continuation of COLA, but there is concern about layoffs, and there is concern about the reduction in delivery. As long as we have a Congress the way we have it today, this administration, the Obama administration, is not going to be responsible for eliminating mail service. And I cannot guarantee that, but my hopes are in that direction. So they needn't fear about having reduced mail service. I don't think the public will accept it. I don't think the administration is going to accept it. So that's one worry that we might forget about. But we've had concerns in the past, when, especially in 1950, when the Postmaster General, a former inspector, decided to reduce deliveries from 2 to 1.
2 days, or two times a day?
We used to deliver mail 2 days a week, Mike. Two trips a day. And he reduced it without any notification to the union to one delivery a day. That caused terrible inconvenience, with letter carriers being stranded out in their routes, having to eat lunch, try to find a place for personal service. It was a terrible thing that went on, but we survived it. And there was a blessing in the end, because prior to that, we would deliver mail in the morning, swing for 2 hours on our own time, and then come back and deliver the second trip. With the elimination of that trip, as a hardship as it was, we only work 8 hours a day. But I'm hoping that the day will come when, as long as we got that mail satchel or that mail vehicle with us, the Postal Service will be responsible for paying for the lunch hour. That should be their responsibility. And while I'm on the subject of the future, I hope the day will come when the management that's responsible for grievances will have to pay for whatever the arbitrator decides is a penalty. That may stop some of these petty grievances that are occurring throughout the Postal Service today.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you speak about the letter carrier, you know, I think all of us understand the point you just made. One of our main contacts with the federal government, in fact, with our U.S. government, is with the postal worker, with the letter carrier. Yeah. And he or she is the person on the street, and I've noticed it's about as diverse as you can get.
That's right.
In terms of who delivers the mail now, it's no longer just mailmen.
That's right.
And do the letter carriers think of themselves as having a special cause? Do you find among the letter carriers that they have a sense of pride?
Most of them do. And while you're mentioning that subject, the Postal Service is one of the few places where the wages of women are the same as men. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be for the remainder of their careers. And that's one thing that's outstanding about the Postal Service. And you're so right about respect for the letter carrier. A recent survey showed 75% of the public favors the letter carrier as the only government servant that is beneficial to them. So they got the highest respect for them. As I've said before, they rescue people. And lately, it's a risky job. We've had a few people killed recently, few people robbed recently, but they go on about their business. We still have dog bites, and we've had one lady who had her face smashed because she put mace on a dog that was about to attack her. So those are some of the risks involved. But beyond the pay that's involved and beyond the guarantee of employment, the satisfaction that comes from knowing that you're anticipated every day at a doorstep in America, I think that comes as a big satisfaction over anything else in the Postal Service.
Well, when you talk about the future, what do you think the future of the Postal Service is?
We're having a difficult time because of the use of emails, which substitute for regular mail. but there's still mail. There's a promise that there'll be no increase in postage next year, and perhaps when the economy changes and improves, the Postal Service will improve with the volume of mail. That's our problem today. Carriers today, in this final months of 2009, are troubled because of what's called pivoting, and that affects the public as well, because where you get used to get mail service at 9 o'clock, they're doubling up on routes because they're not filling vacancies.
And mail, is that what pivoting means?
Yes. They're, a letter carrier would be asked to take the part of a route of somebody that retired whose job is not filled. And that makes an extra hardship on the carrier. So, well, the union is the greatest that I know of, and the job is the greatest that I know of. The benefits are the greatest I know of. There are still some hardships involved. There are still some problems that we experience day after day that people are unaware of.
Well, what about the future of the letter carriers?
I think that the future is great because of the right to collective bargaining. We probably, at our next contract sessions in 2011, are going to have considerable difficulty. There are going to be demands on us. They're probably going to demand to eliminate that COLA, which is costing them money, but which we've earned all these years. As I've told you before, $18,000 of the letter carrier salary comes from COLA, one of the greatest things that ever went in that contract. But as long as we have that contract, and as long as we have the right to go to arbitration, I see a very pleasant future. We have one problem now, and that's happening at the present minute, and that is an amendment that's been attached to a Senate bill by a Republican senator who says that an arbitrator should base his decision upon the financial status of the Postal Service. Why do we need an arbitrator if that's going to be the case? We know what the answer will be. We're doing everything that we can to delete that amendment from the pending legislation, and I know we're going to be successful because it's certainly immoral, unethical, and everything else. If you're talking about an arbitrator, don't tell them how to rule in advance. Let them rule based upon the facts. And we're going to be under great pressure in 2011 because of the situation. But we're strong. We've been through the mill many times. And we have a strong union to back us up. We got arbitration to back us up. And I think everything's going to work out in the end. We just have to be patient like the American people do during this present economic situation.
Now, it occurs to me, from my knowledge of labor history, that the president of the letter carriers union probably spends more time dealing with congressmen and senators and presidents than your average union leader, because, of course, you have one employer, which is the U.S. Postal Service. Can you tell me a bit about just your working with Congress and your philosophy on what you need to do as a labor leader in terms of or some of your experiences dealing with Congress?
Well, Mike, when I was vice president, you asked me what I did. Sometimes I had to testify before Congress. The congressmen are not fully aware of what's happening. They're too busy. It's up to the union to relay to them the specifics of the problem so that they know how to vote. And if they're voting for you, they want to know why. And it's up to us to tell them why. And we've got us in the new president, Fred Rolando, has done that already. And I'm very pleased that he's got the job and that he's a dynamic leader. And I think we're going to be very successful with him. But I've testified before Congress probably 40 or 50 times. One time that a congressman ran out on me was when I suggested that the letter carriers are ready to strike. He didn't want to stomach that, so he left the meeting, but it didn't bother me. He was defeated the next year by letter carrier votes. A congressman should listen whether he agrees with you or not, and he should find out why he doesn't agree with you or why he does agree with you. That's the importance of hearings. You place before Congress what you consider a legislative package, then Congress has a right to ask you what you mean by this. And they go deeper than that. By the time that they're through with the hearing, they know where you stand, and they know whether or not they're going to stand with you. Fortunately, because of the high respect that Congress has for the letter carrier, they believe that what we're saying, because they're also aware that we reach every home in this country every day, and that means something to a politician, believe me.
Yes. I want to ask you before we end about something that just intrigues me, and it's not important in the large scheme of things, but I go to a number of union functions, and I go to quite a few union conventions as director of the Reuther. But the only one where there's a schedule of brass bands is the letter carriers. And I understand, you can tell me if my impression is correct or not, I understand that there is some fairly fierce competition on what brass band gets to play at what time during a convention.
Yeah.
Can you tell me a bit about this?
Well, first of all, let's go back to the Detroit band, which no longer exists. My father was in there as a trombone player, he thought. He was asked to play solo once, and that was the last time he was in the band. The bands are very important. I'll never forget when I first was on the road speaking for the NALC as an officer. I went to San Diego. Before the meeting, they took me to a Mexican restaurant and fed me pretty well. I was called upon to speak, and they had the San Diego Letter Carriers Band in the audience. I was called upon to speak, and I started to get a bellyache from the Mexican food. I said, what am I going to do? I'm just starting to speak, you know. So I thought quickly, and I said, at this point in my speech, we usually introduce the band. So the band started playing, and I ran down the hall. Several branches have bands because they have their meetings and at their state conventions and so on, and they came in handy at my conventions because we'd get into a heated debate over something, and to calm them down, I'll say just what I just told you. Now it's time for the Pittsburgh band. If you don't mind, let's hear the Pittsburgh band. By the time they hear all that beautiful music, the rumpus is over with, and we're back to normalcy. The heated exchange has gone cool. No, they're wonderful additions to our program, and letter carriers' programs are more than just conventions. They're like families getting together. I'll never forget the Boston convention. I didn't expect the kind of a
2008
reception. 2008.
Convention.
I was there because 40 years earlier than that, I was elected president in Boston. So I was there, and I had the privilege of witnessing President Zimbardo get the recognition that he got, which was deserved, and he got that in the form of a building being named after him, and about the he got a bust placed in the lobby. And later I found out there's a little park across from the NALC building that's named after him too. So they've done a good job in recognizing his efforts through the years. But the Boston Convention was wonderful to me. The first one where I was elected, there were two women present, that's all. And both of them were rural letter carriers that belonged to the NALC. At this convention, there may have been 2,000 because of what's been happening. After we got the right to bargain and after the strike, more women came in because they found it's a better job now, it's better pay, and we now have a large number of women. And not only that, not only do we have women, but it's amazing how many women now are the leaders in their branches, state associations, and even at headquarters level, which is a fine progressive report on that.
Mm-hmm. I suppose there is a great degree of equality there, because a female letter carrier can get bit by a dog or run down by a car just as fast as a man could.
You'd be amazed that the average dog bites per year are 8,000 of letter carriers.
Wow.
8,000, yep. But I was very pleased to see you and representing the Reuther Institute at the Boston Convention, because so many people commented to me that they didn't know about that strike, and all that information was available. That was very helpful, I thought. We have to acquaint the younger people that are coming in, and not only those, but people that have come in since 1970. We got to acquaint them that, how did we get where we are? We got to know how we got where we are to know how to be successful to where we're going. And it's an education program, and things like what you're doing will be very helpful. Branches ought to do more of this and get more interest in branch meetings. It's a shame that we hold these branch meetings to explain what's going on and we don't get the turnout, because many of our members take for granted benefits and union policies and so on. So I wish we could get a more interest in what's going on in this union, because that's their life. The unions affect their life, and what the unions can do for them affects their career. So I just wish we could, maybe what you're doing here today could help that cause along.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. Are there other issues or events or experiences that you'd like to have on the recording before we close out?
Well, I think I've poured out my soul to you. I'm very proud of what the accomplishments of the past. I'm proud of this union. I don't know of a greater union that's done more since 1970, since we followed Walter Reuther's instructions, convert to a union from an association. And I'm proud of the people that carry the mail, because these people, in many places, are the only person a lot of people sees. A lot of, when I carried mail, a lot of little ladies that had no one were waiting for those Christmas cards from someone, and they couldn't wait for my delivery. And I thought that was really wonderful, and that I felt good about it. You know, you just feel that you're part of those people. They wait for you and are happy to see you, and you make their life, especially at Christmas. But all year long, so many of our carriers find mail piled up. They know something's wrong because the lady always has taken her mail out of the mailbox. They call the police and they find some poor person laying on the floor, fallen down, or something's happened to them. So they become more than just letter carriers. It's indescribable what that job can do, you know. And I'm reminded of this wording over the post office in New York. They're talking about a letter carrier, and I believe it is so true, having been one and having represented proudly several hundred thousand. This symbol up on top of the New York Post Office says this, that the letter carrier is a messenger of sympathy and love, servant of parted friends, counselor of the lonely, bond of the scattered family, enlarger of the common life, carrier of news and knowledge, instrument of trade and industry, promoter of mutual acquaintance, of peace and goodwill among men and nations. You can't beat that for a motto for a job like being a letter carrier.
You mentioned Walter Reuther. A question I'd like to ask before we close out is, you mentioned Walter Reuther. Who would you say are the most memorable people that you have met over your career, including Congress as well as labor leaders, and maybe who had influence on you?
Despite the fact that some people feel that Jimmy Hoffa was a little bit maybe unlawful or whatever they might think of him, I don't think of him that way. I look at what he did for the people he represented. That's what he's there for, not to satisfy the public. I gave a sermon in Detroit back in 1974, And I called people like Walter Ruther, an apostle of labor, and John L. Lewis, apostle of labor. We had labor organizations until they came across the earth, but they really identified what labor's for, and they did something about it. Many people forget about the overpass bridge where some of our own union members were killed by goon squads. Many people forget that some of our members sat down in General Motors on the floor waiting for their wives to bring them food on what's called a sit-in, very successful sit-in. These are the things that have happened to bring us where we are today, where there is respect for union. There's no respect for union in right-to-work states or in conservative attitudes. They just don't understand, whether it be the letter carrier or the automobile worker. It's tragic what has happened to my own state. It was one of the largest, most professional unions of all time because of Walter Ruther. But what's happened to it is the saddest thing that could happen in the labor movement today. It's tragic. And I just see today that General Motors is going to start repaying the taxpayers. Good. I hope a lot of people will buy those cars. Ford Motor Company didn't need a bailout. That's good too. But the problem is, and we can't convince people because money's involved, the problem is that too many people are driving foreign cars. Before we had foreign cars, we had full employment. Now we got full lots of foreign cars. That's the problem. And I think Ford and the whole auto industry should have realized what was coming and done something about it before it's too late. But I do feel very sad for the people in Michigan right now. But you ask me the greatest, and I think that Walter Ruther, not because you're doing this for that institute, but I've always felt that way, that he has brought the union movement to the surface, sort of a dying movement that people knew nothing about, and they cared nothing about people that labored until it was pointed out to them, who are these people? They're your neighbors, they're your relatives, they're your friends, they're the unions. That's who they are. They're not somebody from outer space. So that's how I feel about it. And John L. Lewis did the same thing for miners, maybe not to the extent that Walter Ruther did, but he was very helpful in the labor movement. But all that a lot of people know about the unions is what the bigoted, prejudicial press tells them. And if the press tells them that they're being naughty boys and girls out there, some people believe that. They don't really know the heart of a laborer. So, but we've come a long way in the labor movement. And they really have raised the prestige and the economy of the country. And if people only understood, in this state alone, the salary of the organized person in the labor movement in this state, which is a right-to-work state, is between 15 and 20% higher than the non-union people. People say, well, yeah, but never mind what. Never mind, yeah. The union's done this for people. And they ought to realize, you know, and get rid of this right-to-work business. We don't care about right-to-work here because 90% of the letter carriers in the state belong, whether right-to-work or not. We don't care. But that's a sad situation that exists, and I know I experienced that when we were trying to get the union shop in during the reorganization plan, where the President of the United States said he didn't mind as long as Congress passes it. But Congress didn't pass it for reactionary reasons. But we don't care because we got the best voluntary union in the world. And I don't say that to brag. I say that because it's a fact. And I'm very proud of this union. And I'm very pleased and grateful that you people at the Walter Ruther Institute are doing this for the letter carriers and other unions, which allows young people, especially in the college, to go through there and see what unions have accomplished. What are they? Like I say, they're people. And what you're doing is an indication of, that you care about exposing what the union does to the American people. That's wonderful.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Now, along those lines then, so a historian comes into the Reuther 50 years from now, or 100 years from now, and they review the history of the letter carriers. What do you hope they'll say about you? What would you, if you could write the history books 100 years from now on, how would you characterize James Rademacher? What would you hope they'd say?
That he did the best he could do, and the evidence is there that he did something.
1970 reorganization.
Well, I did more than that. I mean, I worked, like you said, from age 29 and on, but the most difficult part was overcoming the problem that our members had in getting welfare checks. That was sad to me. You know, I would be willing to go to jail. And that statement that I read to you, which we were going to tell the people of America, there'll be no postal service because their letter carrier is going to be visiting their congressman to do something about the conditions. I didn't have to do that because we settled down to the bargaining table. But I'm glad it wasn't necessary to do that. What people are going to think about me is only if they know what went on. If they don't know what went on, that's why I was very pleased at the reception. I didn't know what they were going to do in Boston. But when I got that opening reception, the first thing I said was, I better quit while I'm ahead. apparently, they remember, and they look at their paychecks, and they see that. You know, I didn't do it alone, because I only served as a messenger. It's because when I appeared before Congress, or I appeared before the President of the United States, I represented several hundred thousand people. I wasn't me, but I represented them. I was the messenger. And I think President Nixon realized that. But when he found out that we had the power to create 3 million letters to him, hey, this organization we better look up to. And that attributed to the no discipline when he saw that support we got. The ABC survey, I forget their names, it was Huntley and Brinkley back in those days, they took a survey. 80% of the American public favored what we did. 80% favored not getting mail service to protect their letter carrier.
It's phenomenal.
Yeah. And that is great. That's because of the respect they have for them. So I hope the letter carrier will respect his own job, respect his union that's there to protect him. Because especially today when the Postal Service is trying to save money, the pressure is on to remove people at the drop of a hat. And they're going to have to realize that the contract is there to protect them. They got to do a job, but the Postal Service has got to do a job also in recognizing who these people are. They're the people that reach America every day. That's the great thing about this union. Other unions make automobiles. They make tractors. They do other things, but this union visits every home in America. You realize what that means? About 160 million homes today. And businesses count on it too, you know. Businesses, people in buildings. And it's just amazing. I'm trying to teach them to respect their job and respect the union that's there to protect them. We've got a contract now that I think takes care of every need. It was very difficult sitting down when this started to start from scratch and write 36 articles of a labor agreement that would be agreeable to the union and management. It wasn't easy because management opposes everything because they know what it's going to cost them. But they knew also these are the guys that walked out, and they can do it again.
It's one of the few strikes
in American history that literally shut down the country.
Yeah. Well, that's why when they told me to get off TV, the more I got at TV and talked to people, the public, why are we doing this? Not to hurt you. We don't want to hold up your mill. In fact, if we had a national strike, as I said, we would deliver pension checks. We'd deliver to the poor, the ill, and we'd get permission to do that off the clock. Well, it wasn't necessary, but we were ready. And this converted us, as Ruth wanted us to do, from a Sunday School Society Association that begged Congress constantly to a union. And that's what we are today. There are times in the past that you wouldn't believe what happened in some of these reactionary congressmen that led these committees. We had several discharge petitions. That's a petition that if you get 218 signatures, you can discharge the committee from handling your legislation and bring it right to the floor. Because the chairman of the committee, Tom Murray from Tennessee, did not believe letter carriers deserved more money, so they're overpaid. So he would bottle up the bill in committee for a pay raise. We had friends who would introduce a discharge petition, including the one in Illinois, but whoever introduces the discharge petition has to be present when the 218 signatures on there so he can bring forth the bill. The man who introduced the bill, the discharge petition, was in Illinois at a convention. Bill Daugherty, president, sent the state police to get him, took him to the airport, got him back to Washington, rushed in before Congress adjourned that night. He brought the bill forward, and the chairman of the committee said, wait a minute, it's not necessary, I'm bringing that bill up tomorrow. And we won. And I was in Texas on the last time that Eisenhower vetoed a pay bill. And again, I say, he was a great general, but he was a bad president, taking the advice of men who had bitterly opposed the unions. And I was in Texas at a dinner, and I got a phone call telling me Congress has just overridden the veto, the only second veto of the Eisenhower administration by the letter carriers. I stood up on the chair and said, we've won. I fell off the chair over the dinner table. I was so happy, and so was our membership happy, that at last we overrode the veto. But I told you earlier, Eisenhower came to the 52 convention. Bill Daugherty, you will never sit on my doorstep. He never was allowed inside the room. Never.
Mm-hmm.
That's how they talk. But he listened to his postmaster general, and there was a little joke we had in Detroit that when Mr. Summerfield was in the hospital, the secretary of the Detroit branch sent him a telegram, allegedly, get well wishes. The executive board of Branch 1 Detroit wishes you a speedy recovery. The vote was 6-3.
That's good. That's good. I like that. Well, any last things for the record?
I think I've told you everything I know. Some of that stuff's never come out.
Well, it's on the record now.
Yeah.
We'll preserve it at the Reuther.
Well, I think if more and more people hear about it and read about it, that we can get more people interested in what this union's all about and that they're here to protect them, including now. If that no layoff had clause had not been in there, and I didn't do it for this reason, I did it for another reason. I'll tell you about the reason. But if that wasn't in there, right now, the carriers would be laid off. Not 6 years, but all of them. Wherever they found a vacancy, out. The reason we put that in there was because there was fear that by going into the Postal Service instead of the Post Office Department, they were going to take away our civil service status. So to satisfy our members, I put in there that there'd be no layoff of any kind, whether you're under civil service or where you're under. And that's in there. That's still in the Clause 6 of the contract. Still in there. And it's going to stay in there, I hope. They'll try to get it out of there. next time, and an arbitrator would have to decide. The arbitrator is going to do a lot of work on that next contract. Mm-hmm. But there are three arbitrators, one representing management, one representing the union, and the arbitrator himself. And incidentally, when I retired, I applied for arbitration and was awarded an arbitrator. I became a full-fledged arbitrator. My first case was with Eastern Airlines, which no longer exists. They invited me. They knew my background. They invited me to come down to a hearing and be arbitrating. And I'm all ready to go, and they canceled it. So then a month later, they said, we'd like you to come down again. I said, I'll come down there, but if you cancel, it's going to cost you $100. They wrote back and said, we don't need you. So I went to become a volunteer in the hospital with my wife, and I didn't bother arbitration anymore because I thought with my background, it'd be hard to get people that would want me because I would be dealing fairly. Not prejudicially.
Well, that's good.
On the Kokomo plan, which is one of the, outside of the strike, the Kokomo plan was the worst hardship I suffered. Management wanted to go out and measure the footsteps of the carrier, whether you're 60 years old or you're 20. And they measure the guy 20 and ask the guy 60 to compete. And things like that went on, time studies and so on. So they put it in Kokomo, Indiana, and they put it in Portland, Oregon. We went to arbitration, and while we were in arbitration, we had a convention in Seattle. The first resolution was, if they put it any further, if they don't discontinue it, there'll be a walkout. And the resolution says, I'm to notify the Postmaster General when the resolution passes.
When was this? What year?
1972. They still had strike on their mind. But they knew what this Kokomo thing would do. So I picked up the phone in the back room and called Postmaster General. But not the same guy, because he quit. The reason he quit, because nobody was disciplined. He got so furious that Nixon would not fire anybody, he quit. So we had an assistant took over named Ted Klassen. I called him on the phone. I said, I want you to know the resolution just passed. He said, you can't blackmail us like that. I said, I didn't. The convention just did. I had to carry out their orders. They voted to do this. So that's, I'm just telling you what the idea is. Well, they didn't go any further with it. And the arbitrator eventually ruled that the Kokomo plan is dead, it's illegal, and that they can't do it without consultation with the union and so on. However, today the Kokomo plan is in effect and they've done it secretly. We've got time recorders that the carrier has to use to record wherever he's at. And if that isn't a spy system, I'd never sort of heard of one, you know. Guy has to leave the route and go to a restroom, record it. Then he gets back, where were you between 12 and 12:10? I was in the restroom. Why do you have to answer questions like that? No. Get the job done, that's all. That's why when I started, the idea was the letter carriers would come in at 6 o'clock, case our routes, and go out. That's it. We had to get out by 8 o'clock. We did it. And there wasn't any pressure on us, but get out. That's it. But today, they look around to see what they can find wrong. You know? Now, the UAW never had this kind of grievances. A grievances that might be 20 or 30 a month. A grievance at the UAW would be something more profound, more deeper, that affected a lot of people, not just a couple guys, you know. So these supervisors have still got a lot to learn about the contract. They brought people in from the outside that don't understand the background of the post office. And then another type of supervisor is the one that used to carry mail, and now he's a boss. Look out for him. Yeah. We used to have a group, they get promoted, letter carrier get promoted to a 204B. He thought he was a postmaster general. So I had a heart attack. And a month after I got out of the hospital, they had this 100-year celebration in Milwaukee. And I was invited to go there. And I spoke and I said, when I was laying there in the hospital, I had a dream. I said, I dreamed that I hung up my satchel for the last time and I was heading to heaven. And all of a sudden, this 204B stops me and says, wait a minute, you're on overtime.
I imagine you got a good laugh.
Yeah, it was a good one, yeah. Yeah.
That's good stuff.
Well, we can't take each other too serious, but when it comes to unionism, it is serious business because there's always people ready to find ways to violate the contract. They're waiting all the time, and they do it. And our good people catch them and do something about it. Mm-hmm. As long as we got a contract, we're going to be protected. As long as the carrier understands what's in the contract, we're going to be protected. That's where education comes in. It's so important. But I'm very happy that the hands are, of the union are now in Fred Brolando's. And I'm very impressed with his appearance before Congress. He's done a very fine job. We won, as a result of his testimony here, we won what's called H.R. 22, which allowed the Postal Service to get more money. Otherwise, I don't know what they'd have done. Mm-hmm. Because they were asked to put in advance billions of dollars for retirees for the future, which is very unfair. Civil Service Commission used to do that. So because of the testimony of Fred Rolando, Congress voted almost unanimously to give the Postal Service that money. So I'm very pleased that he's at control now. And I watched him at their most recent seminar, and he not only talked, but he listened. As people got up there to explain some things that were happening, he listened. He said, and he wrote it down. He intends to do something about it. And that's what you need, is a listener and somebody that's going to do something about it. And that, I think that's Fred Rolando. Yeah, I hope it is.
That's good.
But anyway, we, all of us appreciate what you've done over there.
Well, thank you.
We're honored and privileged to exposed to the public, especially to the young people at Wayne University, what we stand for. You know, we're not some ugly beast on the street corner and mailbag in our hand. We're human beings, like I said. Mm-hmm. And we're in a union because we want to be organized against the powers that be. So the more the people understand that, and the more our members understand it, the stronger we're going to be. Period. 30 dash.
And that's a good way to conclude. This has been a real pleasure. Thank you very much.